was the day before Halloween. And welcome to First Things First. I am Jenna Wolf. That's the Hall of Famer Chris Carter. That is Nick Wright. Nobody does Halloween better than New York City, so if you are in town, enjoy it. If you are not, come to town. Here's what we got for you in the next 3 hours.
I didn't know any of that stuff.
There's a lot of things I could teach you, Nick. A lot of things.
Good morning, America. Let me aim for three right now.
We're going to start strong. It'll be downhill from there. Teams are trying to trade for Odell before today's deadline. Cleveland fired most of its head coaches this week, and the Patriots took to the national stage. That's where we start. Patriots in Buffalo for Monday Night Football. Fourth quarter, Pats don't have a touchdown yet. Brady finds Chris Hogan. He takes it all the way down to the one. Next play, James White rushes in for the score. Pats up 18-6. Buffalo Bills quarterback Derek Anderson mounting the comeback for Buffalo. Instead, he mounts this, a pick six to Devin McCourty. Patriots go on to win 25-6. They've now won five in a row. Here is Tom Brady after the game on how this one ended.
They made it tough on us, and that was a huge play in the game. So we'll take the win however we can get it and try to learn from it and move on next week.
All right, Nick, what did you make of the way the Patriots struggled to just put this away last night against the Bills, or does it not matter?
No, I think it matters. I think everything with the Patriots matters. When you're talking about a team that is one of, I would say, the half dozen Super Bowl, real true Super Bowl contenders, one of the half dozen teams in the league that if they win this championship, you wouldn't be surprised at all. Having it to be a 9-6 game until that Kyle Van Noy strip sack that led to a field goal, having it be a one-score game headed into the fourth quarter, all of that matters against what is the Buffalo Bills are the worst offense in football by far. Like, I understand people say, what about the Arizona Cardinals? If you look at any of the advanced metrics, there is all 31 teams right here and then Buffalo down beneath the table. They have been the worst offense in the league. So I give the Pats credit for holding Buffalo to 6 points, but a lot of teams have had defensive success against Buffalo. What would be at least moderately concerning to me if I'm a Pats fan is you didn't have turnover issues. Brady had played his first clean game from a turnover perspective all year, and yet you struggled to score. They had that one great drive late in the fourth quarter that I believe put the game away because Buffalo being down 2 scores might as well be 12 scores. And then the pick six to officially put the game away. But the Pats didn't look incredibly sharp. They didn't look as good as you would have expected them to look on offense against the Buffalo Bills. Now, they win by 19 points despite all that because they're the Patriots. But, no, see, I didn't think this was a great offensive game for New England.
Right. No, there was a number of things that you can look at and say at this point in the season you would expect New England to be better. So they're struggling. I am concerned. I'm concerned about the absence of Sony Michel.
Yes.
Anytime that you see an offense or a organization move a wide receiver to running back, you know there's problems. Because even Cordell Patterson, as good as he is running the football and opening the space as a returner, the visual lanes and the instincts you need to run the football, they are not there from a skill set standpoint from wide receiver transferring over to running back. It's the reason why you haven't seen a lot of them do it. Number one, a lot of wide receivers catch the ball and are backer to the defense. Running backs, they get the ball, the visually everything is in front of them, so the skill sets don't transfer. For them to move Cordell to tailback, it lets me know they're very, very concerned. So they couldn't run the ball, so that's a concern. The offensive line, when they started becoming predictable, they started having problems protecting Tom Brady. And Gronkowski, to me, doesn't have the same type of burst down the middle of the field. You see, he's not even targeted, trying to stretch the field down the middle. A couple times on the outside, he comes up with the big catch later on. And I'm still concerned about their wide receivers. That's why you hear all the talk as far as them being involved before the trade deadline as far as acquiring another wideout.
So, and I understand there's talk, and we're going to get into it throughout the show, about Golden Tate, about Demaryius Thomas and the Patriots and the trade deadline, which is approaching in a few hours. That's not the position I would target if I were them. Because I think I have seen they still have Edelman. Gronk can still be great in bursts. And Josh Gordon, despite some reports yesterday that he had been tardy and was going to be benched for the first quarter, we saw him out there in the first series. Josh Gordon is going to continue to be a bigger part of this offense. What we saw yesterday is they've got one running back they trust, Sony Michel, and he wasn't there. They got what? Yep. If I'm going to target a player at the deadline, I want to target a running back.
Or because, a defensive end.
Sure, but on the offensive side, I should say. Yes. If I'm going to target a player on the offensive side, I would say running back over wide receiver because I understand Sony Michel is going to be back. But Sony Michel had a knee issue in college. Sony Michel had a knee issue in the preseason.
Yes.
Sony Michel, I think, dodged a bullet for a potentially very serious knee injury last week. But we saw this week, like, the running back production. James White, 8 for 15. Kenyon Barner, 2 for 4 yards. And that's the entirety of it. Other than that, it was Julian Edelman running the ball and Cordarrelle Patterson. Like, if you don't have this Pats team, when they played their best offensive game of the year, at least what I thought was their best offensive game of the year against the Chiefs, it was because they could continually gash the Chiefs on the ground. When they have been averaging 38 a game for the last month, it's while Sony Michel has been playing his best football. If their plan B from Sony Michel is Cordarrelle Patterson, I mean, I've seen the Green Bay Packers try that with old 88 Ty Montgomery, who's in the news for different reasons, a couple of years ago in the backfield. That means you are out of options. And you, so, go ahead.
You wouldn't look at this Patriots team and say, well, this is a team that's one solid, healthy running back away from going all the way back to the Super Bowl. You wouldn't do that. I mean, this is a team that when they want to put up 38 points, they put up 38 points the last couple weeks. I know they didn't have Sony Michel, but Sony Michel was banged up the last time they played as well. What's the one thing that you're
But the last time they played, Jen, and they scored 38, they had two special teams touchdowns. Like, when they – I think –
It's distorted.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I just disagree with the premise a bit. I think for this Pats team, because Brady's numbers look good in comparison to Brady's career, but we have to recognize that in 2018, everything's different.
Yes,
statistically.
All the numbers are inflated.
All the numbers are inflated. We watch Eli Manning, and we say he's finished. He's done.
And visually, for his numbers.
Right, and visually he is. But his numbers say he's having the best year of his career. And so when if Brady's having a career average year in a year when everyone's having a career year, that to me says that the running game is a key part of their ability to score offense.
It's not only the running game. It's that Kenyon Barner's never been a featured running back, all right, since college. Like, he is a special teams player, third down specialist. James White has not been a featured back all his days in Wisconsin, all his days in the NFL, and none of his days in high school. I coached him in high school. He has been a role player. And you can tell by their play calling that they don't have enough confidence in James White. He only had 8 carries, but he doesn't have the girth. Him or Barnes don't have the girth that Sony Michel brings and the power that they bring to the running game. So I believe that's a problem. And when you don't have that, it does not lead to a lot of play action passes. So it gives you chances to get deep shots down the field. So there's a reason to be concerned when you look at the Pats and especially against the opposition. I mean, that's the Buffalo. Man, this is a bad, potentially the worst team in the NFL. Derek Anderson, he was trying to make some golf tour. He was out training. He almost throws for 300 yards against them. So, I mean, no real football fan's going to leave last night's game and say, you know something? New England has built on what they did 2 weeks ago. To me, they have gone a little bit backwards because of the injuries.
So if you're looking at a team that wants to shore up one position before the trade deadline today, do they go out and they try to secure a running back? Well, or do they go get what's rumored to be a wide receiver?
Listen, the only person that has said they should trade for a running back, best I can tell, is me about 5 minutes ago. Like, that doesn't seem to be on the board from the people that are actually reporting. So, like, the newsmakers would, the newsbreakers would say that they are looking for wide receivers. Go ahead, see.
I just wish people would stop thinking that you can go to New England as a wide receiver and offensive player and just pick up the system. Like, we just act as if anyone can go to New England, not only from a skill standpoint, but from a learning standpoint. It's a very complicated system. We've seen veteran after veteran after veteran. How many wide receivers?
You said 27, I think, when they added Josh Gordon from the end of last year to this year.
Yeah, so I don't necessarily believe that they're going to trade for a wide receiver because how effective will they be over the next month? So now you're in the last month of the season.
But, Jenna, to your point, which is they always find a way, despite everything we said, when they had to have it, up only 6 in the fourth quarter, a 10-play, 85-yard drive, a big 3rd and 6 to Edelman, a big 3rd and 6 to James White. Like, because they are so sound from a coaching and so smart from a quarterback standpoint, they even when I thought this was a C-minus level game for the Pats, and they cover the 14-point spread on the road. Like, even but because we look at them with a different eye, as far as can they get back to their ninth Super Bowl, can they win their sixth Super Bowl, it's the little things that we got to pay attention to.
All right, let's take a break. On the other side, why is LeBron running out of patience? Next on First Things First. Hey, we'll get to LeBron in a second, but first, Monday Night Football, Patriots, Bills, Rob Gronkowski, nice sideline catch while managing to keep both feet in bounds.
Boy, they needed that at the time. Big catch by Gronk.
And I thought a good challenge by the Bills, even though they lost it. Like, it was such an important play in the game, and it was really close. I would have done the same thing there.
Yeah, you hope one of those 16s was on the chalk, but he barely got it in.
Exactly
right. On to the NBA. Bulls rookie Wendell Carter posterizes Jordan Bell.
The Bulls had a highlight in this game. Wow. Good for them. Wendell Carter's hasn't stuck out the way a lot of the rookies have already this year. Luka had 31 last night. It was a nice play for him.
It should be against the law after them giving up 90 in the first half to even have a highlight.
90 in the first half.
All right, finally, Hawks rookie Trae Young drops a dime between Joel Embiid's legs. Dwayne Dedman finishes with the wide-open dunk.
Oh.
Go ahead, Trey.
Get the big man with the nutmeg.
Was that the three-hole?
Yeah, five-hole.
Oh, five-hole.
Five-hole. Yeah. I don't know what the three-hole would be, but it's not that. That is the five-hole. There you go. Big game from Ben Simmons in this one last night. I think it was 23-12-9.
Nothing
else. No jump shots.
LeBron and the Lakers back in action last night against the Timberwolves. We jump to the fourth. LeBron hits the three-pointer. Lakers go up 97-96. Less than 2 minutes to go. L.A. now down four. LeBron with the costly turnover. Unusual and understandably unhappy. They would cut Minnesota's lead to two. However, Kyle Kuzma's three-pointer gets blocked. Next possession, Jimmy Butler, big night from him. And he hits the three to ice the game. Timberwolves win 124-120. The Lakers' second straight loss. They are now 2-5. Here's a very frustrated LeBron James after the game.
Well, we got to get better. We know that. We talk about patience, but, you know, we can't have reoccurrence of the same thing. I think, if you... doing the same things over and over and over and expecting a different result, then, you know, that's insanity. So, you know, we have to, we have to get better. You know, we can't keep having the same mistakes over and over.
You've been preaching patience this whole year. At what point does that patience run out? And what do you look like as a leader when your patience does run out?
You probably don't want to be around when my patience run out. I'm serious.
All right, Nick, I know it's still early, but what has to change for the Lakers, at this point of the season?
They got
to
figure out how to close out these games. They have five losses this year. Against Portland, they were down one in the fourth quarter. Against Houston, they're down two with 2.5 minutes left. Against the Spurs, they're up six in overtime. Against the Spurs the next time, they're down one with 35 seconds left. And against Minnesota last night, you said it, down two with 1:20. All five of their losses, they're right there. They have had one game that was clear on either side. That was the Phoenix game, and Phoenix is going to be one of the four worst teams in basketball. They have to close games better, and outside of the fourth quarter, just the entire game, first quarter to fourth quarter, they have to show some type of consistency defensively. They have to show some ability in the front court to be able to stop skilled big men, which they have not been able to do all year long. LaMarcus Aldridge has had a field day against him both times he played. Karl Anthony Towns played well last night, and they have to be, if they're going to play at that pace, that's fine. But playing at a pace doesn't mean you just give up transition buckets. Doesn't mean that you just say, okay, you can go score. We're going to get it right back. So they have to close out games better, and they can't be a bottom seven defensive team in the league. They don't have to be a top seven defensive team, but they can't be a bottom seven defensive team.
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to get better defensively, but I think defensively is the number one way for the team to be able to improve. That takes a lot of time. Now, they're young. They're very, very athletic. They should be better defended, not very good. They've gotten better as far as defending the three ball the last couple games. Now not very good against skilled post people. Their biggest problem, though, is how they're going to close out games. You watch last night's game. When they get a rebound on the defensive set, you got three guys. They had Rondo calling for the ball, Lance Stevens calling for the ball, and LeBron calling for the ball. They have no set offense to be able to run closing games out in the fourth quarter. predictably, LeBron has run the point late in games, and he has orchestrated the whole offense. But he's not able to do that with all these new players, especially when Rondo's on the court and when Lance is on the court, because they are ball-dominant players. So until they decide that they're going to come up with how we're going to close out games, how we're going to play in the fourth quarter, and on the defensive end, getting that part solved, the Lakers will continue to struggle.
Is that a LeBron issue or is that a Luke Walton issue?
Well, I think it's both. Listen, LeBron, you don't get to be the guy LeBron is and then say this is on the coach. Now, he's not saying it's on the coach, but I'm not going to sit here and say it's on the coach. For most teams, that is on the head coach. For the Lakers, it's on both of them. LeBron and Luke Walton need to come together. LeBron's knows more about basketball than Luke Walton, knows better how to put his team in position to win than Luke Walton. I don't know
if LeBron knows more about this team than Luke Walton, because Luke's been around these players longer.
Sure, absolutely. But what Luke doesn't know is, that I think LeBron does, is how to best utilize LeBron with these players. So, like, that's why it's got to be cumulative. Like, Luke knows what these guys' skill sets are better than LeBron does. LeBron knows how to get the most out of himself and his teammates. I thought Luke did something very interesting yesterday. See, you had mentioned you wanted Kuzma to stay in the starting lineup when Brandon Ingram returns. I had said a week prior I thought Josh Hart would take Kentavious Caldwell-Pope's job. Well, both things happened. Josh Hart took Kentavious Caldwell-Pope's starting job, and then when Brandon Ingram came back, they started Ingram at the two, which is not really his position. But so they put Hart back to the bench. They went Lonzo and four bigs, essentially. Lonzo, Ingram, LeBron, Kuzma, JaVale. And so that's a long lineup, but that is a lineup that doesn't really fit as far as who are you going to play that against? You know what I mean? Like, what are good teams that can you finish a game with that being your five-man lineup? And speaking of Lonzo, see, yesterday he struggled. He has struggled throughout the year. He has not taken anything. I know it's only seven games in, but he looks like the exact player he was last year. And last year it was fine for a rookie. But in year two, you need to see that development as a player.
Does it help that the brunt of this locker room is young? Maybe they don't get so restless so quickly that they're able to bounce back from games like this, that a close game is, we're getting there, as opposed to veterans who can sort of pick out what's wrong and it kind of weighs on them more?
Well, we've seen LeBron with a couple of different teams. We've seen him with the Heat and with the Cavs, and they struggle. Veteran players, young players, because coming together on the basketball court, because they don't spend a lot of time practicing. So you are learning on the run. You are actually learning in these games. And let's not overreact. If they get a couple stops, and the Timberwolves made some big shots in this game.
Jimmy Butler made
some big shots. And so I'm not going to overreact to what they're doing. I prefer veteran players compared to younger players. I believe it's important for younger players to win. Veteran players, if they've been around the league long enough, their confidence is going to take a lot more to ruin their confidence than young players.
I'm not going to overreact either. However, the 2-5 does mean if they're going to get to 50 wins, that's 48-27 the rest of the way. That's winning almost two out of every three you play the rest of the way. Now, they've had a schedule thus far this season where they have played nothing but playoff teams except for Phoenix and Denver, and Denver was the last team out of the playoffs last year. So they have played, even by Western Conference standards, a tougher-than-usual schedule. But the thing that I don't think it's too early to worry about is Lonzo. I want to see, like, Lonzo's still not comfortable at the free throw line. Lonzo still is not comfortable taking any type of jump shots other than set three-pointers. Like, I want to see how I thought Lonzo could pair beautifully with LeBron through seven games. We're not seeing that. As far as like on-court, off-court net rating, he's been the worst Laker by far. I need to see that next step for Lonzo Ball when it seems like there's less on his shoulders than it was last year. There's less noise surrounding him than it was last year.
Like, why would you think that?
Because last year, I feel like Lonzo, it was a topic of discussion every single game. Go ahead.
Yeah, but the pressure in your second year with LeBron, now all the optics, everything in the NBA is on him. He's a new dad. He's trying to figure out playing with this great player. And also, if he wants to continue with the Lakers, there's a lot of pressure for him to improve. So there's more pressure on you in your second year than in your first year. Like, I don't know what's happened that would alleviate pressure from him. More pressure's been added to him. You have Rondo there. Like, there's more pressure. There's more eyeballs on them. We're reporting on every game. Last year, man, there'd be three or four games. We didn't care nothing about the Lakers.
So maybe it's there's just less noise surrounding him with his dad and the second overall pick and the things Magic had said. And I understand what you're saying is there's more expectations for Lonzo this year for sure. And if you're saying expectations.
I believe this year's more real pressure. All that stuff. There's a lot of crazy parents. There's a lot of parents that say things. But there's real pressure on his basketball game because his critique is going to be on his game. And as you see, man, he don't have no intermediate game. He don't have no jump shot outside of a set shot behind the three-point line. So those things, I believe, are real pressure in year number two.
All right, Lakers fall to Minnesota. Good test for them against a team they might be fighting for a playoff spot with. All right, coming up, why did the Browns finally move on from Hugh Jackson? That is next on First and Second. This week on Thursday Night Football, Bay Area rivals square off as Derek Carr and the Raiders take on the 49ers. It all starts at 7:30 Eastern on Fox, NFL Network, and streaming on Prime Video.
I thought the Raiders were going to get a win this weekend. They had, through three quarters, a lead against Indy, couldn't hold it.
Time to go viral. Check this out. 41-year-old Vince Carter, who won the dunk contest all the way back in 2000, showing he still has hops. Nice little windmill dunk.
I mean, Vince, man, his love of the game, as he discussed with us, and just, hey, why'd I go to Atlanta? I want to go somewhere I could play, man. I'm not here to try to piggyback some ring. I want to be able to play and still get up, man. A windmill at 41?
Keep playing, bro. Keep playing. Keep playing as long as you can.
No doubt. Vince and Dirk.
And then when you get done, you can play on my team.
Adult league team.
Yeah, I need a small forward, something like that, power forward.
Stories to start your morning, sponsored by Gillette Clear Gel. The Patriots beat the Bills 25-6 last night. New England now 6-2, winning their last five games. Chris Carter, what was your biggest takeaway from last night?
Oh, they struggled. They missed Sony Michel. Their inability to be able to run the football. You could see Tom Brady in them, and they had a lot of energy into this football game. They normally dominate the Bills. Brady has had a stranglehold over the Bills. Yeah. This is, you would think Belichick would leave this game and say, I thought we'd be further along than what we were as far as our passing and running game offensively.
And I agree with all of that, though. What saved them was what typically does save the Pats. If it's close late, they will put together one drive that salts the game away. After not being able to put together a consistent drive the entire game, 10 plays, 85 yards to seal the game before that pick six. But, yeah, you saw how much they missed a true running back in Sony Michel handing the ball off to Cordarrelle Patterson when we know he's barely a wide receiver, much less a feature running back.
NFL trade deadline is at 4 p.m. today, and it looks like the Lions are trying to move on from Golden Tate. Detroit is reportedly seeking a mid-round pick for the wideout. Nick, you surprised by this?
I'm very surprised by this. Lions are one game out of first place in a division that seems winnable. They're 3-4. The Bears are 4-3 with the worst quarterback in the division. And, yeah, sure, if you were going to get the Amari Cooper deal for Golden Tate, sure, I'd do it. But a mid-round pick, when you're in the playoff hunt in Detroit, that does surprise me that he'd be on the market.
Is Golden Tate up for a contract?
Yeah.
Okay. Where'd that coach in Detroit, where'd he come from?
New England.
Oh, okay. Where do you think he learned it? This is exactly what New England does. Last year, your contract, veteran player, tried to get rid of you, and he's not the guy that had Golden Tate there. So I wouldn't be surprised if they move from Golden Tate. Good football player, especially in this new NFL where they throw the ball and the catch and run's important. He's the best in the league as far as catch and run wide receivers from the slot.
All right, shake up for the Dallas Cowboys. They fired their offensive line coach, Paul Alexander, on Monday. Dallas sits at 3-4 and will try and make a playoff push starting Monday night against the Tennessee Titans. CeCe, were you surprised by this move?
Well, they fired a number of coaches this offseason. For them to fire their offensive line coach who has more resources than any other group in the building, yes, I was very surprised. And now it's going to be in. What were they displeased with his inability to do with that offensive line? Because they're very, very talented. This to me is just a little puzzling. You know, also Jason Garrett. They start firing your coaches. They come for you next.
Well, this is the first midseason coach firing Jason Garrett's ever had. So, like, that's why it is.
Well, it's not him. It's Jerry Jones.
Okay,
Jason don't even have the power to fight. Okay?
He can't even fire his offensive line coach, see?
No.
Jerry Jones in there breaking down film with Steven.
Well, he got to call him to be able to get approval.
Okay, that part I believe. Listen, you might be right.
Jason, what you want this morning? What you want me to do for you? What's going on over there?
Well, I don't think the offensive line coach has done well with the loss of Travis Frederick.
Oh, man, I've been watching film. That offensive line's rolling off that ball. Zeke is eating. When Zeke's eating, we're doing all right, Jason. I like it.
I think we can do better at the coaching spot there, Jared. Do you mind if I fire him?
Well, I normally don't say this, but I'm going to trust you, Jason, on this one.
I appreciate it, Jared. I won't let you down.
Clay.
Finally. Oh, what a night for Klay Thompson. He went off. He made 14 three-pointers. That's an NBA record. He also scored 52 points in just three quarters of action. Eat that, Steph Curry. As the Warriors dismantled the Bulls, 149-124. How impressive, Nick, is this feat for Klay?
This dude is unbelievable, man. He doesn't get any of the shine because he's never been the best player on a team. Right now, he's clearly the third best player on his own team. But as far as the best third wheel any team's ever had, he's got to be at the top of the
NBA.
List. In the history of the NBA.
Like, absolutely.
What Klay Thompson has in my lifetime, four of the most remarkable individual scoring efforts. There's the Game 6 saving the 73-win Warriors against Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. That third quarter, those 11 threes over the game. There's the 37-point quarter he had a couple years ago. There's the time he scored 60-plus in 29 minutes of action. And then there's last night. He shot 24 threes in 26 minutes. Do you know how exhausting that is? Like, he was taken out midway through the third with 52. NBA record for threes attempted, threes made. He could have scored 75. Like, I mean, I don't know what to say. This guy, when he had been having the worst, see, he was shooting 15% from three before last night.
Oh, yeah.
He hadn't scored 20 in a game before last night. Oh, let me get all those averages back up in one game against the Bulls.
Yeah, we saw him at the Garden against the Knicks. Jen and I, we were there behind the bench, and you can see Klay before the game. So it was real. He was shooting 15% from three. You could see him. He struggled in the warm-up. He struggled in that game shooting the ball. Klay needed this. They had Kevin Durant went off in that game, so they've been kind of rotating which guy is going to go off. I would say him and James Worthy are the best threes of all time. Now, James Worthy, they had Kareem, Magic, and James Worthy as the number three. That's when Showtime was one of the best basketball teams. This right here, when what Klay's doing, phenomenal. How special was it, Jenna? Last night, 52 points, 56 dribbles, 96 seconds. That's how long he had the ball. 96 seconds to be able to get those 52 points. So it's amazing to be able to shoot the ball with that consistency the way he did. Man, he was in fuego last night.
And if we're going to go further in the pantheon, Elgin Baylor, the older Elgin Baylor, when he was the third best guy on some Laker teams that weren't ever quite good enough, you could put him on the list. But Klay Thompson is, to me, he is certainly in the argument for the best third guy on a team we've ever seen. And I got to say, to steal a line from my buddy on Twitter, Dragonfly Jones, other Warriors, I need you guys to start point shaving in these games. I need these games to be close, and I need to see if someone can go for 80. Because when you're up by 40, everyone gets benched. But if we're talking about the most impressive scoring performances in the NBA this year, do the Warriors have all three? Steph's 50 through three, Klay's 50 through three, and Durant's 25 in the fourth quarter in the game you were at. Like that, and I guess Blake's 50-point game, these guys...
Yeah, Jen and I show up, they keep it close, at least for three and a half quarters. Eight minutes.
Yeah, and then they bust him in the head in the fourth quarter. It's unbelievable, man. Congrats to Klay Thompson.
Moving on to interesting times in Cleveland. After a shaky start to the season, as well as rumors of power struggles with their offense, the Browns fired both head coach Hugh Jackson and offensive coordinator Todd Haley yesterday. Defensive coordinator Greg Williams is now the interim head coach. Here is Browns owner Jimmy Haslam explaining the move.
I think we did what we thought was best for the organization. I think that we put the organization in a better place today than it was yesterday moving forward, and we're comfortable with the decision. It's hard to win in the NFL. If anybody knows that, it's us. And I think the message today is we're not going to put up with internal discord, that we want people who are collaborative and work together.
All right, see, I mean, we talked this week that it would probably be after the Chiefs game that we would see some movement within the coaching hierarchy in Cleveland. But were you surprised that they fired both Hugh Jackson and Todd Haley when they did?
I was definitely surprised they fired both. I thought that Todd, especially in a chance to try to resurrect his career after a not the best dismissal from Pittsburgh, with his relationship with Ben Roethlisberger and some of the other players there and some issues that he had off the field, I thought that Cleveland with Baker Mayfield would be a great spot for him. Obviously, and you could see through Hard Knocks, you have to be careful when you watch some of these things, that there was going to be a power struggle. I could see in the tape between Todd and what he coaches and how he tries to coach and go after it, being a disciple of Bill Parcells, I could see there was a conflict there with Hugh, and ultimately it trickled down into the team, so they had to move in a different direction. This is an organization, though, that I don't think this is the best move because I can't trust the guy because he's done this four other times before. This would be his fifth head coach he's hiring. Why would I trust him to be able to get it right? And as an owner, why didn't he, if they had discord in the building, why didn't he squash it? Why didn't he do something before this? Like, what was he doing while all this was going on? So I feel bad for the fans of Cleveland, and I feel bad for the players whose career are in this organization's hands, because you don't go to Cleveland at this point as a player and get better. Like, they ruined more careers than they enhanced, and they got some good young players. Ward, the quarterback, Baker Mayfield, Miles Garrett, the defensive end. They got some good football players, and they should be better than what they are right now.
I mean, listen, if you're a Cleveland sports fan, you have to deal with right now what is the most paralyzing thing in sports: bad ownership. And that's on the basketball side, which we'll get to later, and on the football side. Jimmy Haslam took over this team in October of 2012. That's 6 years ago. He's about to hire his fifth coach. He's already hired his fifth. He's on his fifth general manager. Like, what? That is absurd. And I understand that why you'd move on from Hugh Jackson. He's 3-36-1 with Cleveland after being very. Listen, they could have won the Pittsburgh game. They lost to Oakland in overtime. They lose to Tampa in overtime. But two of the last 3 weeks, they got blown out. They played good teams and they got blown out. So I understand moving on. And Todd Haley has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way in his career. But at some point, you can't have this power struggle end, of course, in a tie to where you fire them both when. Now who's calling plays for Baker? The whole franchise relies on Baker. And now the guy that's going to call plays has called plays in one game in his NFL career, and it was a preseason game. And Greg Williams is the last man standing. Bounty gate Greg Williams. Like, I didn't think the makeover would work. The new haircut and the glasses, it worked. Like, he's going to get to be an interim head coach for the final half of this season. Like, this is, you've got to have a plan going into the year. And I thought, the reason they brought in Todd was because if we have to fire Hugh, we can have an offensive-minded head coach who's called plays, who can steward Baker through his first year. To fire them both, to me, is inexplicable. I knew one of them would go. I thought it'd be Hugh. I didn't think it'd be both of them.
Would you say this was a wasted year for Baker Mayfield then?
No, I wouldn't say it's a wasted year because we saw flashes that no Baker can be a primetime player in this league. We believe him to be a franchise quarterback. But you got to be able to support him. So, no, he's with the Browns. He's going to be the face of the Browns. I got faith in Dorsey, the general manager. The general manager didn't hire the head coach. So he ultimately had to get rid of him. The general manager did pick the quarterback. All right, so they are married together. Now the general manager can hire his own coach. So for me, I knew this was going to happen. I was hoping it was going to happen after the season because you got to protect Baker and protect his talent. All right, you can't afford just to give away the season, allow him to get hit, and say in these last eight games and stuff, say they only win one of those games and they got two wins now. They've shown drastic improvement. Try to build on that.
So, listen, there's going to be a very wide, big, you know, net thrown out there to see who's going to come in and to be able to work with Baker and to be able to work within this organization and to work with this owner. Who's out there that you like?
Well, listen, the guy that everyone on television today is going to mention is Baker's coach from college, Lincoln Riley, a guy that coached Baker, that is the hot young coaching candidate. But it goes back to what C started with and what I started with. If you are a hot candidate, if you're him, if you're David Shaw, if you're Eric Bieniemy in Kansas City, do you want to go work for Jimmy Haslam? Do you want, for your first NFL coaching opportunity, where you pick up your family, where you move, where you put your kids in new schools, you do all that to be for a guy who no one has lasted more than 2.5 years? Like, can you trust him? Can you trust that John Dorsey, the guy who's going to hire you, that he's going to be there more than 2.5 years? Like, that's the concern. If you're a great coaching prospect, do you want to go coach the Cleveland Browns?
Well, I think you're wasting your breath thinking about Lincoln Riley. I mean, he's been there a short period of time. It's been a great transition from Stoops over to him. Why? What makes us think he can coach grown men? All right? Nothing. He hasn't done anything to make us think he can coach grown men. So I would move him off the list. I would look at guys who have established themselves, guys like Chuck Pagano, who's available, Jim Caldwell, who's available, young, bright minds, Eric Bieniemy in Kansas City, offensive coordinators doing a great job there, John DeFilippo there in Minnesota, who also did the work with Carson Wentz. Those are guys who I would start to be looking at, and potentially Josh McDaniel in New England. Because eventually, I believe he will leave New England if the package is right for him.
Do you think, even if you're not on the Lincoln Riley side of it, whomever the Browns target, do you think if they have any other NFL offer, they would take the Browns? Is Baker enough of an allure to overcome what is the ownership question?
I think the opportunity, what they have there defensively, they got some good pieces as far as the players there. And you're really banking on Dorsey. Dorsey as the general manager, all right, someone's going to take this job.
Of course.
And yeah, it still is a good job because if you can get to 8 games, you can get to 7 games, the improvement. Other organizations, I believe, are going to have the same type of struggle. You're going to have to take a chance as a young coach if you're trying to get a job. I still believe it's a good job. All right. There's a lot of bad owners. All right. There's a lot of bad presidents around these universities, these college coaches are working for, too. So you have to be able to take, where am I going to take a risk? And eventually someone's going to win in Cleveland.
All right. Got to take a break. Coming up, could the Giants fire sale continue at today's trade deadline? That's next on First Things First.
Coach, you bring
on the bats.
Coach.
Back here on First Things First, head coach Eric Mangini joins us.
Good morning.
Was that spooky enough
for
you?
It's so festive here.
So festive and spooky. Let's talk some Giants. Big Blue, now a big disappointing 1-7, and thus have turned their sights on a little thing we like to call next season. Ahead of today's 4 p.m. trade deadline, Jay Glazer says the Giants have gotten decent offers for Odell Beckham Jr. And when asked if Eli Manning will be the starter after the bye week, head coach Pat Shurmur said, "We'll see." That's what I like to call a real vote of confidence. Coach, how should the Giants handle their future with both Eli and with Odell?
Well, with Odell, nothing can change. They just signed him to a huge contract. If they moved on him from now, the amount of acceleration from his signing bonus would be...
It's $20 million.
It'd be huge.
$20 million.
Huge
Coach, what does the acceleration mean?
So it's spread out over the life of the contract, but as soon as you cut a player or trade a player, that all comes into the current year or to next season. And typically that number in the first year or second year of a contract is so big that you can't cut a guy, you can't trade a guy. And that's why when we talk about, you know, Odell being happy and all those decisions that go into it is once you sign a player to a contract like that, they really have the leverage on the organization as opposed to the organization being able to control the player or at least have some sort
moderate his behavior.
Yeah, moderate his behavior.
Listen, I don't want to get too far in the weeds on this. I want people to understand. They absolutely 100% they wouldn't. They can't cut him. It'd be like $45 million acceleration if they cut him. The way his contract's structured, they could trade him. It would be $20 million accelerated against the cap this season immediately. And because they moved on from Snacks and Eli Apple, they could make that work. So it's on the board. It
and
would
I tell
be
you, as
irrational.
As an owner, I'd be pretty happy where I could have paid a guy $8 million, but I get to pay him $20 million, right. And then I have a salary cap hit.
Right.
I mean, if it was me, I'd be like, yeah, that's really good business. Let's do that.
That's
yeah, cost me another $12 million for a guy I could have got for $8 million, and I only played for 8 games. So if they make that decision, you know, there better be a lot of people. There's going to be a lot of we'll sees about next season.
That's almost exactly what I was going to say. Like, I understand teams calling about Odell Beckham. He's on pace for 1,500 yards this year. I understand why if I were a team and I needed a wide receiver, I'd be curious if the Giants want to cut bait. But it would be totally irrational of them to cut bait. Like, it's not like he hasn't been productive. He did the interview, which everyone hated. I understand that. And the team's been awful. But it's hard to assign much of the blame on the team being awful on him, at least more on him than on anybody else. And so if you were to trade him now, what it says is you have totally changed your opinion of the player in 3 months. And it's not like the interview should have shocked anybody as far as because, like you said, once you are who you are, and usually getting money just exacerbates who you are, doesn't change who you are. So I understand why teams would call about Odell. I have no idea why the Giants would even consider trading Odell, particularly if they're going to be drafting a quarterback. What a quarterback's best friend could be is an elite wide receiver.
Yeah, I'm going to put the Odell thing in the Lincoln Riley category. Only going to make one comment about it because I know it's not going to happen. Lincoln Riley's not going to be the coach of the Cleveland Browns. Odell Beckham is going to be on the New York Football Giants. That's a decision that they made months ago. Now, what are some of the other changes about Eli being the quarterback? Those things are possible, but Odell is with the Giants. If there's one thing, Barkley's going to be with the Giants and Odell's. Now, if you want something else, you can call. People have talked about it. If you didn't trade for Odell before the contract, you're not going to be able to get him in the first year of the contract. So I think there's other legitimate things that the Giants are going to have to do as far as wholesale changes. I don't believe Odell is going to be one to change.
Well, the Giants get rid of Eli Apple. They get rid of Snacks. Clearly, they're in some semblance of a rebuilding mode. Can you build a franchise around a wide receiver? Or does it look like there's a quarterback coming out that you could do that around?
Well, I don't know if the starting point is going to be there, but they have made a significant commitment to him, and then they have that piece in place. So that's got to be part of the building process. But what I'd like to see is hear from is Dave Gettleman. We heard so much from Dave Gettleman prior to the season. He was pretty much interviewed every week, and he had a lot to say about where the team was going, why they were making the decisions they were making. I'd like to hear that now. A lot of times what happens is you get mid-season and the head coach goes out week after week and decisions are made and the head coach goes out week after week. But the decisions aren't his decisions. They're coming from the top down. Maybe they're collective. But why don't we hear from him during the bye week? What are his thoughts about trading these players? What are his thoughts about signing the left tackle that he signed, about the once-in-a-generation back that they only run 13 times a game? Let's hear some collective thoughts about the progress of this team. Suddenly it's radio silence.
Yeah, the reason why he's not talking is because he doesn't have good things to say. And you're right about the coach. It's not fair to the coach. They are sending Shermer out there, and we know they're rebuilding. It should come from up top. Either the owner or the general manager should say that we're rebuilding, and then it makes sense to trade Snacks. It makes sense to trade Eli Apple. It makes sense to build a bench Eli. So in doing that, you actually empower the coach compared to doing what they're doing now, where they don't have any direction what they're going to do. So the coach is like, it's week to week if we're going to see Eli or not.
The other big news we talked about was that when asked if they were going to start Eli after the bye, Pat Shermer said, we'll see. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think they're going to start him, as C has said, until they get to 10 losses. I don't know if there's a hard and fast number like that. I think they will give Kyle Lauletta at least 2 games and no more than 4 games at the end of the year. But I do not think after firing the GM and the head coach and having all the controversy last year of benching Eli Manning, that after the bye, 8 games into this year, they're going to bench Eli Manning.
It just feels like we're watching the same movie again.
Yes.
Where last year the head coach was pressured to bench Eli Manning. It was his fault. Mm-hmm. It was all Eli's fault. So they bench him. Then Eli becomes a sympathetic character, mm-hmm. you know, where he has that role. And then the head coach gets fired. And now we're in the same situation where we may have to bench Eli Manning, or they're getting pressure to do that. You know, is it going to be the same deal? What about running the ball more? What about running the ball more than 13 times a game? You've got this back that you have a
he said Hall of Famer. He said my mom. Gettleman said my mom knows. She knows we're going to draft him.
And his mom probably knows that he should carry the ball more than he's carrying right now. Because when you have a quarterback that's not mobile, being able to establish a running game, and is he great in between the tackles? No. But does he have a chance to hit a home run every time he touches the ball? Yeah. So keep giving him the ball to allow Eli the opportunity to build some play action off of that.
And I would argue, if you take a running back at number 2, if the argument to taking him at number 2 is, we just thought he was the best player. It wasn't about quarterback. It wasn't about position need. It was, we thought he was the best player. Then this whole, he's not great between the tackles. Use his rookie year to see if he can become great between the tackles, or at least better than you thought between the tackles. Like, a player of that caliber, I don't think we should say, maybe you disagree, Saquon Barkley will never be great between the tackles, just not in his skill set. Like, then he's a specialist. And you can't draft a specialist at number two. Like, you have to draft the back that, yes, can hit a home run. Yes, he can go catch the football. But also can be a guy, when need be, that you can hand the ball to between the tackles. Like, if anything else, you need to use the rest of this year to help Saquon take the steps towards reaching his full potential as a pro.
Ever since kids were 8 years old, you give them the football, you know where they run to?
Besides?
Run to daylight. That's what running backs run to. And when you don't have holes to run through, you know where they're going to run? They're going to run outside. So when you have a bad offensive line, so you can say what you want about your running back, until they spend some capital and get that right, that offensive line, the quarterback, is that, that's a second and third question, because you don't want to put a young quarterback behind that bad offensive line. So they got to spend some money on the offensive line and be able to get that right, because all the money they threw at the Nate Solder, I knew it. I knew he wasn't going to be a dominant run blocker. I knew he wasn't going to help them the way the Giants thought, but no one else was saying that. So the Giants have a number of questions they must answer, and a lot of it has to do with the talent.
And you asked, Jenna, is there this quarterback coming out of the draft? Because one thing that is true about the NFL in 2018, most teams, they might be wrong, but the vast majority of teams in this league think they have their quarterback. They've either drafted him in the last couple years, or they're an older quarterback that isn't going away anytime soon. You would say the Giants are on the list that need a quarterback. The Bucks might be on the list. We'll see about Oakland. Oakland says they're not on the list. Jaguars should be on the list, but they're not going to be drafting in the top five, we don't think. But this might not be the year for it. The kid that everyone says would go number one, Justin Herbert from Oregon, not exactly a place known to be an NFL quarterback factory, he might stay in college another year to play with his brother the following year. After that, you're talking about Drew Lock from Missouri. Maybe your guy Haskins is going to come out, but as much as you like Dwayne Haskins, is Dwayne Haskins really going to be coming out early in the number one pick of the draft? Like, is that what we're talking about? So even if they are deciding, which they clearly are, next year we're moving on from Eli Manning, where's the quarterback coming from, particularly if Herbert does not come out?
I don't care about Haskins. I don't care about any of that stuff. All I care about is the next eight games. They're in a bye week. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do so that the team knows they're committed to winning? You start trading away players. You don't give an explanation to it. Then there's going to be a bunch of players in the locker room who are going to make a business decision, you know, whether they play or whether they don't play.
Yes.
There's got to be a commitment to this head coach, to this program, to this philosophy, to where everybody's going to play. Everybody's going to play hard. Everybody's going to be committed to New York Giants over the next eight games, or they're not going to be here. So forget about the quarterback next year. Let's make this team better right now, and let's see some tangible things that are different than what we saw the first eight games.
Coach is fired up. I love it.
It's just like the quarterback.
Yeah. Cue the bats. We're going to break. Coming up.
Cue the bats.
New reports of Aaron Rodgers' reaction to Ty Montgomery's misstep. Wait till you hear what he has to say
about
that.
Coach is fired up.
Coach Mangini, Sunday's Rams-Packers game ended with Ty Montgomery taking it out of the end zone, fumbling, and denying us all of a potential Aaron Rodgers comeback. Reports are Rodgers was not happy when this happened, screaming for Ty to take the bleeping knee on the sideline after he fumbled. Some in the Packers locker room believe Montgomery went rogue. Sounds more dramatic that way. By taking it out of the end zone, even though Montgomery denies this. Coach, what do you make of the Rodgers' frustration that we saw on Sunday?
I actually feel that his frustration in that one situation was legitimate. The guy shouldn't have come out of the end zone. The question is Ty Montgomery a bad guy? Is Ty Montgomery a guy that historically defies what the coaches ask him to do? And the things that I've read, the things that I've heard, is that that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he took it out of the end zone and there was some confusion there, to me, is more problematic. How was that not as clearly explained as possible? That there's time out before it happens. That you have a chance to huddle up and say, okay, this is what we're doing. So it's hard for me to look at Ty Montgomery and say, okay, this is a guy who clearly went rogue and did his own thing. There's some disconnect there. And if I was Aaron Rodgers, I'd be frustrated about that fact, that in that situation, because I do think Aaron Rodgers plays really good situational football. In that situation, there was some kind of miscommunication which led to this.
And some of that, in my eyes, especially given the history, has to fall on the coaching staff. And here's why I say that. One of the things we compliment Bill Belichick on all the time is his players never do things like this. They always understand time, score, situation. They're never running out of bounds when you're trying to run out the clock. They understand all those things. So the flip side of that is if you have a team that this has happened multiple times to, then all of a sudden, is it not being coached up? And what do I mean when I say multiple times? How about the closest Aaron Rodgers has come to making a second Super Bowl? Do you remember what happened in that Seahawks-Packers game? Onside kick, Seahawks, and Brandon Bostic went rogue. Brandon Bostic's job was to block on this play. The ball's going right to Jordy Nelson. Bostic, I got it. No, I don't. And said after the game, I know what my job was. He felt terribly. McCarthy was mad. But he didn't follow his assignment. Now, maybe that's unfair to say that's on the coaching staff, at least in part, but what I know is that there are very clear assignments. I know that the best coach team in football, the New England Patriots, their players seem to always follow those assignments. The Packers make the Super Bowl. We get the Super Bowl we've always wanted, Rodgers, Brady, if not for that play right there. And so I understand I'm going back in the archives because that's a famous play. I'm not pulling something from earlier this year in a similar situation. But we have instances of Rodgers being denied an opportunity. I understand his frustration. And of guys who have a very clear job just not doing their job on those types of plays.
Look, I wish I could say that everything New England was done exactly the way we wanted it to be done all the time. But there are times where players make mistakes. There are times where players feel like they can make plays. But that is the it's the exception. It's not the rule there. And things like this are frustrating. And it's frustrating across the board when you have one guy who decides, I'm going to do this. And very rarely does it work out in a positive way for the team.
Yeah, I've been on teams that guys make mistakes in critical situations. And regardless of how well you're coached, when you're in that moment, it's very, very difficult as a professional athlete to decide in milliseconds what's the right thing to do, what is my training. And most of the time, the training is to be aggressive. As far as Bostic going after that ball, he was clearly chastised by the coach on the sideline. I just don't like to make excuses for a game that's very, very difficult to play. And when you're in Montgomery's spot, you want to be able to make a play. He could have misjudged the ball. That could be the excuse for him drifting back into the end zone. But what he is accused of and the character of the player, they don't match up. So a lot of times, this could be his first critical mistake as a professional. These are highly contested games. This is not the regular job. This is not where your boss tells you, hey, I need you to have a new assignment. No, NFL jobs, they don't work like that. And there's a lot of pressure. And guys make bad decisions under the gun. And we can't always blame coaches because things happen at 1,000 miles per hour. And sometimes you have to live with those judgments. That's why you coach guys up for situations so you can prepare their minds visually, physically, for what's getting ready to happen so when it happens, you don't react the wrong way. That's why you rehearse catching the football time after time after time again. And the reason why when I drop one, why I would get disappointed because I had trained myself for that moment. And a lot of times players, man, they make mistakes at the wrong time. And this is the reason in team sports, you have to depend on so many guys. And that's why you can't, if a guy doesn't win a championship or something, you can't call a guy Aaron Rodgers. That don't make him not a champion because he's on a team with guys who have made mistakes in critical situations.
I think it's easy to turn this into a disciplinary conversation and say, well, he made a mistake. He wasn't listening. He should be disciplined for it. But I think what you said is on the table. The game's going 100 miles an hour. He made a split decision, perhaps the wrong one. But there were a couple plays before that where he also
Well, listen, I think one of the reasons people may be unfairly calling his character into question is, according to Mike Silver's reporting, a few series prior, he had had, I don't know, I think it was described as something of a tantrum on the sideline because he was taken out of the game. When he was put back in the game, he missed an assignment on a block on a key third down.
I haven't seen a really good player The coach say, hey, you're out of the game. Sure. You say, hey, coach, oh, thank you.
No problem.
You did me a dang on favor. Oh, thank you very much.
No, I get that.
You don't make it in the NFL with that. So, yes, you're going to have a natural reaction.
I'm just wanting the audience to understand where the story's coming from. They didn't read Mike Silver's story. But I thought UC made a really good point yesterday that's only amplified by the rule change this year. And the point was, you're told put your heels on the goal line. And if you have to step back, then you take a knee.
That's how I train all my kids.
But they made a rule change this year, which is if the ball lands in the end zone, it's not a live ball. It's dead. You don't even have to catch it this year. In the past, that's a live ball. We'd seen the once every 5 years, ball land in the end zone, no one touches it, it rolls around, you pick it up for a touchdown. That's not on the table this year. So it's a touchback if it just lands in the end zone. So you can have your heels on the goal line, and you don't even have to catch it if it's going over your head. You can just let it go.
What becomes the problem is when you try to force your will on a game. When you try to say, I'm getting ready to do something in this game, and the game does not call for you to do something. When I'm in a team sport, it calls for me in that situation to get the ball to Aaron Rodgers at the 25, north of the 2-minute warning, which the coach said, with one timeout. Go ahead, coach.
One of the things that happens is when you add pressure to a situation, a player or human being's focus narrows, and they can only take so many cues at that point. So if you've got a guy that's already emotional, who's going through some struggles, and he's going into that situation, you got to make sure that you very clearly explain to him, this is what we want you to do. And you know, you'd like to imagine that was what is done. But in those moments, those guys sometimes make mistakes like they do. Now, what I don't like as a coach is if he had taken that out and gotten it to the 50, would they be giving it attaboys?
Or they be saying it was still the wrong
play?
Yeah,
because to me, Custy Amato, the famous trainer, said you got to train guys so much that they can't screw it up even if they want to. And so if you're giving someone an attaboy when they take a chance that's outside of the scheme and make a play, then it's hard to go back and criticize as a coach if they do something like he did. And I don't know what that dynamic is in that locker
room. One quick comparison to New England, Cordell Patterson. He brought out a kick out of the end zone in Chicago, fumbled it, ended up being a critical turnover. He did redeem himself and make a big play later on. But the philosophy for them this year, they're going to be more aggressive. It's a philosophy. But New England players, they make mistakes.
Oh, for sure.
So it does happen. It's just a philosophy in that situation should have been to take a knee. New England has decided this year with Cordell as the returner, we're going to be more aggressive because of newer rules.
All right, Coach, we'll see you a little bit later on. Coming up, will the Cavaliers ever recover from losing LeBron? That's next on First Things First. On Saturday, the 8th-ranked Buckeyes are looking to get back in business against Nebraska, 11:30 Eastern. Then Big 12 contenders West Virginia and Texas clash at 3:30 Eastern. That's coming your way Saturday on Fox or watch anywhere on the Fox Sports app.
Man, make sure you watch that West Virginia-Texas game. You might get a football game for the first 3 hours and then a coach fight at the end. You never know.
No. Watch that Ohio State. I might be having some people over my house to watch the Buckeyes game. We're going to put a beat down on Nebraska.
We will get to LeBron in a second, but first, Monday Night Football, Patriots, Bills, Rob Gronkowski with a great sideline catch, managing to keep, look at this, both feet inbounds.
Man, but this was Gronk's biggest play of the game, one of the Pats' biggest plays of the game when the game's still in doubt late in the fourth quarter. I would have challenged as well. I don't blame McDermott for challenging it here.
This is one of the things that makes Gronk so special. His catch radius so big. You can't guard him outside the numbers. What other tight end can you line up outside the numbers? Throw him a fade against a corner, safety, linebacker. Don't matter.
Not a big fantasy night for Gronk. On to the NBA. Bulls rookie Wendell Carter posterizes Jordan Bell.
Listen. I'm all for giving some rookies, that especially under the radar rookies, even though it's top five pick Wendell Carter, some run in the show. But when you give up 52 to a guy in 26 minutes like they did Klay Thompson, I don't know if the Bulls deserve to be in this show.
I don't know which is more impressive, the 52 they gave up to Klay or the 92 they gave up the first half. I don't know how they made the show. Who did that?
Deontay's back. We got to blame him.
Deontay.
The show.
And finally, Hawks rookie Trae Young drops a dime right between Joel Embiid's legs. Dwayne Dedman finishes with a wide open dunk.
Oh, I see you. Now, this was definitely – he targeted this one.
Where'd he go, see? Through the what?
You say the five hole?
There you go.
Oh, shoot.
Through the five hole.
I got to get them numbers right.
Nutmeg. Good game for Ben Simmons, who didn't make the highlight. Near triple-double for Ben Simmons. How many jump shots he makes, see?
Zero.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Come on. Every night. I ain't even gonna stat shoot.
I love you guys.
That's accurate. I might have been wrong about Ben Simmons developing a jump shot this offseason.
How about them Cavaliers? After losing their entire team last season in LeBron James, and after starting this year 0-6, the Cavs fired head coach Tyronn Lue. Bit of a head-scratcher considering they did lose LeBron, and Lue won the 2016 NBA title and went to the finals all three seasons at the helm. Regardless, he is out of a job this morning. Here is LeBron on his former coach.
I had, 3.5, 4 years of great years with Coach Lue and that team that we was able to put together. He put us in position to win. He put us in position to succeed. And then, more importantly, he gave all the onus on the players. So he gave us the responsibility to go out and do what we need to do to win ball games. And, that led us to, three, while he was at the helm. Eastern Conference Finals, three finals, one championship. Got a lot of nothing but good stuff to talk about, T-Lo. But that whole situation is beyond me.
CeCe, what was your reaction to the Cavs firing Ty Lue?
I went out on Canal Street, and I got me some bags because I'm giving away a lot of my clothes and everything because I lost a little weight and then also fashion forward. But I got all my Cavs gear. I've been cheering for the Cavs for a minute. My boy Ron Harper played for the Cavs back
from
in the
Ohio.
Day. LeBron, since the time they drafted him. Man, all Cavs gear. I got Cavs sweats, jerseys, hats, everything. I put it all in one bag. I'm headed over to Career Gear later on today. They get ready to get all my Cavs stuff. Because Ty Lue was the last thing. I like Ty Lue. I don't believe he's a great basketball coach, but I believe he did right by that organization. By going against one of the greatest teams ever put together, what Ty Lue, what he put this organization with LeBron, like, look at those players without him. Now, you can say LeBron and everything.
Never won a game.
But you got to give this coach some type of credit to be able to manage those situations. So, wasn't good news for me, so I packed all my stuff up. I'm like JR and them. I ain't got no shirt on. I can't wear no Cavs gear. I'm done with the Cavs, Jenna. The people over career gear, you're getting ready to get a Cavs stuff.
I would like to be the first person to publicly congratulate Dan Gilbert. Got your team back, bro. Last year you were saying privately, it's reported, can't wait for LeBron to leave. Get your team back. Well, now LeBron's gone. Got rid of Ty Lue, most successful coach in the history of Cleveland. Not the Cleveland Cavaliers, Cleveland, the city. You got rid of Damon Jones, too, just because he's LeBron's guy. Sure, no problem. You're the worst team in the NBA. Greg Popovich would have been 0-6 this year with this Cavs team. I was saying it last year. I was saying it this offseason. I saw Vegas set the over-under at 31.5. No chance. This was a 20-win team last year that LeBron carried to 50. And so that's the level of talent on the roster. To put this at the feet of Ty Lue is an abomination. And I can tell you for a fact.
Yeah, I don't think them firing them, they're putting it at the feet of Ty Lue. It just lets you know the overall dysfunction. Like, you don't go to four straight finals and then after six games decide he can't coach anymore.
Well, that to me, like, that there was.
What are they doing?
He and Kobe Altman never got on the same page. Kobe Altman wanted them to play the young guys more. Ty Lue was partial to the veterans. Or else, I mean, because if it was something we just wanted to turn the page entirely, you do it in the offseason.
Before the season starts.
It's a difference in philosophy.
But here's the reality. That last year's Cavs, as great as LeBron is, they were going to go the other way. I was going to have to eat more crow on this television show than anyone's ever done. Because they could have missed the playoffs. Talk to guys, veterans on that Cavs team. Ty Lue kept them together. When LeBron was touch and go, when LeBron maybe was losing touch on the season, Ty Lue kept them together. He took over a team mid-season 3 years ago and led that team.
I think people forget.
He takes over mid-season. Leads him to an NBA Finals.
Your bad decision by hiring David Blatt.
He takes over under very adverse circumstances. NBA Finals down 3-1. They win the championship. Go ask people what happened in the locker room of Game 7 on the road against, up to that point, the greatest team ever. Ty Lue challenging LeBron. We need more out of you, LeBron. We need you to be better, LeBron. LeBron getting mad, going to James Jones, saying, what's he talking about? And James Jones saying, Ty is right. and then they win the title. How about last year? You lose Kyrie Irving right before the year. Your trade haul for him is terrible. You have to remake the roster three times. Kevin Love leaves the team. Ty Lue has to briefly leave the team due to health issues. Comes back. What do they do? Game 7 on the road in Boston, where LeBron's second-best player is Jeff Green. Ty Lue's part of that win. To act like anyone could have coached this Cavs team, anyone could have coached LeBron, it's not accurate. It's disrespectful to Ty Lue, and it's why Dan Gilbert is who he is.
Dan Gilbert believes that LeBron was responsible for all of it, that LeBron coached the team, that LeBron kept the team together, that LeBron won the titles. I'm sure he assumed that it was all LeBron James and Ty Lue's coaching was no part of it because they come into this year. And I'm sure this was what he wanted to do earlier on. Why he waited six games is a little mind-boggling.
This is all about ego. It's all about ego. He wants control of his organization. He's got it. And a lot of times when people are very, very rich, they think they're smart in a lot of different fields. Typically, they're not. And Dan Gilbert has shown that. With LeBron James, look at his record. With LeBron James, he's really smart. Without LeBron James, he looks just like anybody else on the street. He can't manage the salary cap. He can't manage his roster. No good general manager is going to ever go there. Why? Because he can't be trusted. So it's eerie similar how the Browns and the Cavs, their ownership is right now.
Listen, the only prescient, intelligent basketball decision Dan Gilbert's ever made is when he was trying to buy a basketball team, he bought the one located closest to the hospital LeBron James was born in. Every other basketball decision he's made has been throwing darts, just guessing.
And that wasn't his first choice. If he can buy any team, he'd buy Detroit.
He wanted to buy Detroit. The best choice he ever made, he lucked into. And he lucked into LeBron coming back. And now, enjoy 11-71. Enjoy it. Like, you got your team back, you wanted your team back. I feel that Ty got disrespected, but you know what? Okay. He got his $15 million, and he doesn't have to deal with these losses pulling down his 128-83 record.
Are we going to see Ty coaching again?
Ty need to go somewhere and relax, man. That's what he need to do. Last year, he had some serious health problems. He need to take care of his body. He need to lose himself some weight. Relax. He got $15 million. Sit back somewhere, Ty. Don't rush off anywhere. Let's not forget what he emotionally has gone through the last 4 years on and off the court.
No doubt. But when he is ready to coach again, if he doesn't get immediate head coaching interviews and opportunities, then something's wrong. The guy's 41-20 in his career in the playoffs, has won a game 7 on the road in the conference finals and the NBA finals. Like, the idea that Ty Lue is some, I don't think he's one of the five best coaches in basketball, but the idea with all these guys that are clueless that get to run basketball teams, Scotty Brooks getting chance after chance, sorry Scotty, Donovan still coaching, like Ty Lue, when he's ready to coach again, should be a head coach in this league.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up, has Jameis Winston played his last snap for Tampa Bay? Next on First Things First. First, we are going viral. Check this out. Celtics teammates Kyrie Irving and Jason Tatum getting in some work after practice yesterday. So you always talk about how they don't really get a chance to practice in the NBA. How important are these types of things for a guy like
Tatum? I'm sorry, did Kyrie make it? Oh, that's the same amount of shots as he made Friday night. That's dope. Good for him. Go ahead, C.
Somebody laughed.
Go ahead.
It's very important, Jim. This guy. Everything comes out of Boston is spicy out of his mouth. Old spicy mouth man.
Oh, me and Jim.
I'd love to be able to see him get that little work. Because it's a huge part of it. They're not going to do a lot of running up and down the court, but it's a lot of isolated individual. And Tatum has grown his game. He's the best player on the Celtics.
Yeah, Tatum could teach Kyrie some things.
Look, it's amazing we saw it. Look, there's 37,000 reporters around someone who I can't see. And then these two are like, you know, this is when we can get some practice.
They're around Danny. No. They're around Brad Stevens.
Oh, Nick, you're full of shade today. Well, could have been Danny.
I'm glad that was shade. Like, I was like, what's happening? Like,
is that not shade?
No, you got it right. I thought you were going to say I'm full of something.
Yes, that would have been my second favorite lady on the show behind the British lady.
It's like Jenna.
The one that flames Nick.
Let me spell it for you.
Hot like Klay Thompson. Flame him. Shoot that three, Jenna.
Stories to start morning. Sponsored by Gillette Clear Gel. Klay Thompson went off last night. 14 three-pointers. That's an NBA record. Also scored 52 points in three quarters of action as the Warriors dismantled the Bulls 149-124. How impressive was Klay last night, Nick?
Here's how impressive Klay was last night. Is this one of his three best scoring performances ever? What does it displace? The game six against the Thunder, the 37-point quarter, or the time he scored 60-plus through three quarters? Like, it's got to place with this guy. When he catches fire, he's the best I've seen. When he catches fire, I've never seen someone quite like him.
It's pretty special. Jenna, 56 dribbles. It only took the score 52 points. He had the ball actually 96 seconds. That's all shooting.
96 seconds.
96 seconds. That means he's getting it, shooting it. A couple dribbles, shooting it. Behind the pick, shooting it. It was an awesome performance. Happy for Clay. He was off to a slow start
after
this season.
After being cold all year. Yep, exactly right.
The Lakers lost to the Timberwolves last night. Jimmy Butler, 32 points for Minnesota. Lakers fall to 2-5. CeCe, what has to change for the Lakers now moving forward?
Well, I had my scout at the game, my daughter, Monterey. She was sitting in row six. She lives in Minneapolis. She was doing a little scouting for me, so a little sourcing.
What did Monterey say?
Monterey said that late in the game, they don't know what they're doing with the ball, Daddy. They don't, like, go to – like, when we used to have season tickets in Miami, you know, they used to have a couple things. They either go to Dwayne Wade in a little pick and roll, or LeBron, they put him in the corner, then they isolate him. They don't know what they're doing, Daddy. I was like, oh, girl, you good. See, grew up around basketball, around LeBron. She knew it. They ain't got no way to close out the games.
And listen,
that's Monterey Carter's scouting report.
A few things. Yes, they need to get better. Every loss this year, they've been right there. Two points in the final few minutes or a smaller deficit, and they haven't been able to close it out. So that's a problem. Their defense on dominant post players, LaMarcus Aldridge gave them work twice.
Yes.
Karl Anthony Towns gave them work last night. Also, LeBron had a bad turnover late. His ball handle, he's never been a great ball handler, only great for his size. But his ball handling this year has been shaky. They ended up being able to, despite the turnover, cut it to 2 with a minute 20 left, but they couldn't close. Another loss for the Lakers.
All right, shake up for the Dallas Cowboys. They fired their offensive line coach, Paul Alexander, on Monday. The Dallas Cowboys are 3-4, and they'll try to make a playoff push starting Monday night against Tennessee. Chris, you surprised by this move?
I really am, because I don't know how you're going to improve as an offensive line. It's where they've spent the most amount of money. It's also where they spent the highest draft picks. It's the best group that they have on the team. Now, I could see that the standard for them to be very, very high because they have so much talent. But how do you get better as you're in the season firing the offensive line coach? It's a little puzzling to me.
CeCe, who's the coach of the defense on the field?
The middle linebacker.
Who's the coach of the offensive line on the field?
The center.
And he's gone.
Yes.
So maybe what they've learned through eight games is Travis Frederick, in addition to playing his position at an all-pro level.
Okay, that's a great observation.
That he has been coaching up on the field. Make sure you got this guy. Watch this check. And without him, they are seeing not only lesser play at the center position, but the other guys, so they thought they could get better. But what's jarring about this, Jason Garrett's never on his staff had a midseason firing until this one. So they saw something on film they did not like.
Mm-hmm.
All right, finally, the Patriots have won 5 in a row, but they might not be done improving their offense. According to reports, New England is interested in trading for a wide receiver and particularly interested in the Lions' Golden Tate and Broncos' Demaryius Thomas. See, should the Patriots try to get another wide receiver?
Of the two that you mentioned, I think the Patriots have several needs. All right, they have some depth problems as far as running back. They could still use another pass rusher. They could still use another linebacker. Missing Dante Hightower last night, you could see him being out of the lineup. I don't think that they're going to trade for a wide receiver. The position is too hard to learn. I talk year after year, year after year, about the Patriots system. And offensively, it's very, very hard for wide receivers to be able to learn that. Now, Golden Tate has the type of skill set
he'd be so deadly
that for New England, but I worry more about his personality. He is a very outgoing guy. He has a good time on the field. He showboats a little bit. Like, I don't know if he's a Belichick type guy. He could play for my football team. Demaryius Thomas is very, very limited. He's deteriorating as an athlete. I don't believe he's a great deep threat down the field. So I don't believe they're going to make a move, but there's a lot of noise. I believe they'll be active. I just don't believe they're good another wide receiver.
The Pats are known to be involved in trades during the season.
Yes.
It's usually trading guys away. It's trading Jamie Collins away. Mm-hmm. I can't remember.
Chandler Jones.
Chandler Jones. Like, it's moving on from guys. it's rare that during the season they bring in via trade a high caliber player. Now, I know they just during the season brought in Josh Gordon. That seemed to be like almost an anomaly situation.
That fell on their doorstep.
Right. He was going to be cut. They got Josh Gordon and a seventh for a fifth round pick. So, I mean, they gave up as minimal draft capital as you can get up to get a potentially really good player. Here's my question about Golden Tate, because I'm not that interested in Demaryius Thomas. I am now of the belief Demaryius Thomas at his apex was mostly a creation of Peyton Manning playing some of the best football we've ever seen, because since he left, before his athleticism fully declined, you saw his production drop off a cliff. But Golden Tate does most of his work from the slot these days, right? Like, that's where he's his. Am I wrong about that?
He does most of his work from the slot, but he's not a slot receiver exclusively.
Okay, so that's.
He's played outside an awful lot, and he's got the speed, the burst, and his releases off the line of scrimmage.
So
he's not challenged athletic.
Okay, because Edelman can only play the slot. So yes. I want, if they were going to bring in Golden Tate, he would have to essentially move to the outside, but you're confident it's something he can do.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and as far as would I do it, it's not what I would target. I would target a running back if I were them. With that said, if the reports are right and you get Golden Tate for a mid-round pick, if you can get him for a fourth-round pick,
take it.
Even if it takes him a month to learn, it'd be worth a flyer to me. Now, I don't know why Detroit. I know he wants a new contract, but I'm a game out of the playoffs if I'm Detroit. If I get a first-round pick for Golden Tate, then sure, I'll make my team worse for the opportunity to make my team better this offseason. But for the 120th pick of the draft, I'd rather have the final half season with Golden Tate, see if we make the playoffs with Matt Stafford.
All right, let's move on. Talk about the Bucs and their quarterback, Jameis Winston, because he might not be the Bucs quarterback that much longer. He was benched after throwing four interceptions against the Bengals on Sunday. Since returning to the lineup, Jameis has thrown 10 interceptions in four games. Yesterday, head coach Dirk Koetter named Ryan Fitzpatrick the starter this week against the Panthers. All right, Chris, what do you think? Did Tampa Bay make the right move here, benching Jameis Winston?
When a player is playing as bad as Jameis is, because in your interior offensive lineman, you can be having a bad game. You can be playing against a superior talent. You can be playing against someone like Aaron Donald, give up two or three sacks. They're not going to bench you, because we can help you. We can bring the center. We can bring a back, Chip, bring a tight end in, Chip. So we'll try to help you out. When you're a quarterback and you're playing bad, it's hard to hide you. It's hard to hide a quarterback, especially when you're down the way they were down and you know you had to throw the ball. And Jameis, it's like Steve Young taught me this. He said, Chris, you have to be able to judge your quarterbacks on, because there are going to be days when it's going bad.
On their work.
He said, which quarterbacks will say, you know something, this is enough. Like, I'm done playing bad. I'm Ben Roethlisberger, if he throw three interceptions in the first half, hey, you can chalk it up. He will throw five, because Ben, he don't care. Yeah. Ben, but the other great quarterbacks, typically you see them at least get a little more cautious with the football, understand that I'm going to stop it here. Jameis, I didn't see that. If they didn't bench him, he would have thrown six or seven interceptions in this game. And I just don't – I missed on Jameis. I thought Jameis would be a lot better, especially after seeing him in his first 2 years in the NFL. I thought he'd be a lot better by now. So I missed on Jameis as a quarterback. I thought he'd have better anticipation. I thought he would read defenses better, because he's a smart guy from a football X's and O's standpoint for those who quiz kids on things like that. So I was really, really wrong on what I thought Jameis was going to be in pro football.
He forced their hand in the game and heading into this week. They were down by less than two touchdowns when he threw that pick six. That was his fourth interception of the game. He has now thrown 10 interceptions on 148 pass attempts this year.
Wow.
One in every 15? Come on. Like, you are not giving your team a chance to win. And by the way, I watched Jameis' last year at Florida State. The year after they won the championship, turn the ball over too much. Every year as a pro, turn the ball over too much. And Dirk Koetter doesn't want to do this. They got rid of Lovie Smith because Lovie Smith, who I didn't think deserved to get fired, they got rid of him. Why? Because
yep.
Dirk Koetter and Jameis have this amazing bond. Dirk Cutter's going to get the most out of Jameis Winston. Dirk Koetter knew going into this year, the only way I keep my job
is
Jameis Winston is successful.
Yes.
And he can't even play him anymore. Like, I already had been skeptical of Jameis as far as, the person he is off the football field. And now on the football field, he has shown that he has regressed. I don't think you were wrong after 2 years. After 2 years, he looked like the guy who was going to turn into a franchise quarterback. The problem is, not only has he not gotten better in year 3 and 4, he's gotten worse. And so he's had the opposite of a progression.
So we know what's going to happen next week. But have we seen the end of Jameis Winston in Tampa Bay? Is it now Ryan Fitzpatrick's team the rest of the way? And now they'll just figure something out for next season?
Jenna, I know you do this. We go back and forth. Because I know about right now, you probably have all kind of love for Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Okay,
I know
that is not true.
You love to see when a guy comes off the bench
against the odds
and just go in there and just blast it and really have success. But there's a reason why they're backups. It's because Fitzy will throw 4 interceptions this week. So for me, I got to go week to week with these two guys. If they had different characteristics, I would say, okay, yes, I think we should go with Fitzy for the rest of the season. But Fitzy, man, we got to try to win as many games as possible. Fitzy will throw you out of the football game. If I thought he was going to be consistent, then I would say, yes, Jameis on the bench. Jameis is done in Tampa. But Fitzy, I know better.
Here's the only reason why it wouldn't matter to me who the backup quarterback is. I wouldn't play Jameis again this year. Jameis has a fifth-year option coming up for $21 million. It is guaranteed for injury only. They can move on from Jameis, $0 against their cap this offseason. Unless what? Unless he gets hurt playing in a game throughout the rest of this year, and he can't pass that end-of-season physical. We saw RG3 deal with something like this, where the team knew they didn't want that option, and so they just kept him off the field, even though he was ready to play because they were worried he would get hurt, and then that money would become guaranteed. If I'm worried about, now maybe Dirk Cutter's not, because he's not going to be there to have to concern himself with this probably, but if I'm at all worried about the long-term health of my cap and my franchise, if I've decided internally we need a new quarterback, I don't want to run the risk that Jameis is on my roster, on my cap, for $21 million next year. That's why the Jags had to extend Blake Bortles. Couldn't pass his end-of-season physical. That fifth-year option became guaranteed. So now we got to extend him for an extra year to lessen that cap hit. I don't want to run that risk with Jameis. I don't let him play for my football team again.
Ryan Fitzpatrick. Coming up. What happened?
That's cool.
Was firing Hugh Jackson good news for Baker Mayfield? We'll talk about that next on First Things First.
What happened?
This week on Thursday Night Football, Bay Area rivals square off as Derek Carr and the Raiders take on the 49ers. It all starts at 7:30 Eastern on Fox, NFL Network, and streaming on Prime Video.
You know, Hub, who works on the show, he's out there with the Raiders. Gruden brought him in for a tryout.
Absolutely. Maybe quality control coach.
He's not here today.
Who knows?
Maybe he's contemplating.
Man, our staff gets a lot of time off.
Someone brought that to my attention.
Back here with Coach Mangini.
Hugh Jackson time off.
Speaking of time off. After a shaky start to the season, as well as rumors of some power struggles within their offense, the Browns fired both head coach Hugh Jackson and offensive coordinator Todd Haley yesterday. So defensive coordinator Greg Williams is now the interim head coach. Here's Browns owner Jimmy Haslam explaining the move.
I think we did what we thought was best for the organization. I think that we put the organization in a better place today than it was yesterday moving forward, and we're comfortable with the decision. It's hard to win in the NFL. If anybody knows that, it's us. And I think the message today is we're not going to put up with internal discord, that we want people who are collaborative and work together.
That being said, he's fired like 27 of his headquarters.
Well, he's fired 5 in 6 years.
So. There you go.
What
do you make of the firings yesterday, Coach?
Well, on July 28th, he said, my commitment to Hugh Jackson is unwavering, and I got to give him a lot of credit for bringing in Todd Haley. So that's what was said July 28th, and we fast forward to 8 games in the season, and there's internal discord. And look, there's oftentimes internal discord on a coaching staff. People have strong opinions. People have strong beliefs. There needs to be a chain of command. I totally agree with that aspect of it. But did they sit down with the GM, the head coach, the offensive coordinator, and the owner and say, look, this needs to stop? Was there anything, was this addressed prior to making this move, or was it just accepted that there's internal discord and we have to move on? And the idea that this is a better situation for Baker Mayfield, I don't know how that's possible. Yeah. Look, hopefully Freddie Kitchens does a great job. It's his first time as an offensive coordinator. But you're sending years and years of offensive experience out of the door. And say what you want about Hugh Jackson, say what you want about Todd Haley, but to make the argument that from a developmental standpoint or from a football knowledge standpoint that Freddie Kitchens and the new group is going to be able to push Baker Mayfield forward in a way that the other two guys could, I don't see it. I do not see it.
I think it's crazy to fire them both. Like, I understand, and, I mean, we were talking yesterday that the only coach with a worse record than as a head coach in the NFL than Hugh Jackson historically is a guy named Burt Bell, who also happened to own the team. So, of course, he couldn't get fired because he was also the owner. I would understand if they said, you know what, 2-5-1, not good enough. The fact that we've been blown out 2 of the last 3 weeks after only winning one game in the previous 2 years, not good enough. I also would have understood if they would have said, you know what, Todd, you had a rocky end in Kansas City. You had a rocky end in Pittsburgh. We brought you here, and we're not going to let it get bad. Even though I like Todd, I would have understood firing either one of them. But when the franchise is the quarterback, to fire them both and to put it in the hands of, as you mentioned, a guy he's called plays once in his life for one game, once in the preseason. It seems to me to have no foresight. It seems like they did this just so Jimmy Haslam could say, we're not going to tolerate discord. Okay, well, you're going to have some discord when you are about to be on your 10th head coach general manager. Like, he's on 5 general managers, 4 head coaches, about to be on his 5th. He's only on the team for 6 years and 2 weeks. Like, that's no way to run any business.
Yeah, I have a huge problem with them firing both because Baker Mayfield. Baker Mayfield's the prodigy. It's like you're taking advanced calculus in high school. And then all of a sudden, they come in. The principal comes in and says, you know something? Your teacher, she's not going to be here. He's not going to be here any longer. And the gym teacher is going to be teaching you calculus. And now you got this prodigy in there in math, and he's looking at, like, what am I supposed to do? Because that's where Baker Mayfield is today. To think that Baker Mayfield's career is in better hands today than it was in yesterday, we'd be naive to ignorant. And Coach and I, we know you cannot take that type of football knowledge out the door and it not affect that kid. And we believed that Baker's path, he was on the right path. He was getting coached hard. He was getting some experience. He had some bumps, but he did have some success. He's a guy that you have to make sure that he don't get the football knocked out of him. And this is why I always like to support coaches and players, because this league, man, you can be ruined by bad management, by bad owners. And that's what's going on in Cleveland. You think those guys have a chance to have a great career? When the owners, how many coaches? 5?
This will be his 5th coach.
I mean, what would make us think that he's going to go about this? You think he's not going to go to the same search firm? You think he's going to go to the NFL? The NFL has a list of candidates I'm sure that they're going to give
him. He could go to the homeless guy who told him to draft Johnny Manziel. He could go to him.
Man, I'm just saying I don't have a whole bunch of confidence. I think Baker Mayfield's going to be a baller, can be a great, but you are at the mercy of your ownership, and you got to be able to support Baker Mayfield there in Cleveland.
And, Coach, it's not just Baker. You have Baker and you have Myles Garrett. You have a bunch of really good players on this team for the first time in a long time who need to be coached. Besides sitting everyone down, what would you have done? How would you have liked to see this all sort of work itself out?
Well, there's a lot of issues here, but we talk about Odell Beckham all the time, and people understood the challenges that Odell Beckham presented. And look, Todd's a fiery personality. People understand that Todd has that type of personality. So it was no secret when he was hired that there was probably going to be a little bit of friction.
Would think with his relationship with John Dorsey, that because he wouldn't be coming there unless he had a good relationship, that Dorsey would be able to control him.
And it would be one of those things. And I've sat down with players who had difficult reputations prior to coming into organizations that I was running and said, look, if this happens, this is what we're going to do. And we're going to sit back down this table, we're going to discuss it, and we're going to get to a point where we all understand what's happening. But now they're in transition again. And in transition, whoever the new head coach is, there's going to have to be changes because that guy's going to like a certain type of player. That guy's going to like a certain type of scheme. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to change again. And there's this incredible inefficiency with change that teams like New England or the Steelers or other teams that have continuity constantly are able to prey on, because everything has to transition now. And it's a nightmare.
Coach, what type of edge would a team have? Let's just say they were average across the board in coaching. All right? Just whatever the league average is, coordinator, head coach, all of it. Just the exact median of the league. But they were in place for 7 years.
You would like to think that they would have a significant advantage because for the players, you build reps. You build on experiences. You understand what's expected on the playing field. But not just that. There's the component of the scouting department, the free agency operation. Scouts know what they're looking for. There becomes an efficiency there. It's the same thing with free agency, that you can utilize the salary cap in ways that you can't when you're changing.
There becomes a trust factor, too. I remember when we got Chip Myers as a wide receiver coach. He was a 6'5 former wide receiver. And he taught me a lot about coming out of my breaks. And after he taught me that, man, I trusted him with anything. I was excited to come to work. I was like, Chip, what do you have? So when you have that experience together, that coach knows what I can do, but that coach also knows what I can't do, and we're going to trust each other more than this continuing turnover that they have like in Cleveland.
And I'm not advocating that Hughes should have stayed with the record that he had, but they should have probably made that move last year, mm-hmm. not at this point. You get into 8 games into the season, and now
it's a thrown-away year.
The new head coach comes in, and the last time he coached was 2003.
Right. It's worse than a thrown-away year because if I change the coach should have a right. Maybe I want to play a 34. Maybe I want my outside linebackers to be small. Maybe I want my inside linebackers to be big. Maybe I want more of a speed team. I want a small team. So it's more than just a year changing to what coach is talking about.
And when did John Dorsey come in? He came in late in the season last year. Yes. He had the advantage of coming in during the season and seeing Hugh Jackson coach, seeing what was there. He had a huge head start over other guys that come to the situation. So to make this decision now, it just seems reactionary.
When the Niners hired Shanahan and Lynch and gave them both 6-year deals, I had no idea if John Lynch was going to be a good GM. I still don't know. I knew he was out of the broadcast booth. I liked him as a broadcaster, as a human being, but who knew if he could do that job? Kyle Shanahan, I knew he was a very good offensive coordinator. No idea if he could be a good head coach. But I loved the idea if I'm San Francisco, they're both on 6-year contracts together, and you're going to have the continuity. Look across the state if you're Cleveland to Cincinnati. They have, I think, the definition of a league-average quarterback in Andy Dalton. I think Marvin Lewis is fine as a head coach. I don't think he's one of the best. I don't think he's one of the worst. You know why they don't bottom out? Because of that continuity. They're 5-3 right now, Cincinnati Bengals. The Browns mm-hmm. would swim across whatever Lake Erie for 5-3 right now in the season. And so, I mean, you're not gonna get anything close to the peak of your talents if every 2 years you're going through this.
And look, the 6-year contract, that was more of a PR thing than I think a real commitment because mm-hmm. all those contracts are written in pencil anyways, and paying off coaches
sure.
like a rounding error for most organizations. So it was a nice, you know, idea. Let's see whether they actually commit to them for 6 years if they continue to struggle like they do. But the idea of changing every year, it's futile. It's futile.
And it probably takes a toll on the players, which...
Absolutely.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. All right, Coach, stick around. Coming up, are the Patriots looking like the best team in the NFL? That's next on First Things First. Saturday, the 8th-ranked Buckeyes look to get back in business against Nebraska at 11:30 Eastern. Then Big 12 contenders West Virginia and Texas clash at 3:30 Eastern. That's coming your way Saturday on Fox or watch anywhere on the Fox Sports app.
Buckeyes putting 60 on Nebraska.
I'm watching at your house, C. Big party at C's house this weekend. Huge college football Saturday.
Yeah, no problem. Come on over.
Coach Mangini and I, we're gonna watch from the gym. Speaking of which, he's still here with us. We're talking Monday Night Football, fourth quarter. Pats don't have a touchdown yet. Brady found Chris Hogan, who takes it all the way down to the one. Next play, that was James White, who rushed it in for the score. Pats up 18-6. Bills quarterback Derek Anderson mounting the comeback. That's not what a comeback looks like. That's a pick six to Devin McCourty. Patriots win 25-6. They've now won 5 in a row. All right, Coach, what'd you make of the Patriots struggling to put away the Bills last night, but in the end, putting away the Bills last night?
Yeah, the Bills have played some games that are surprising. The game against Minnesota obviously was an extremely surprising game. They've got the ability to do that, and it's a Monday night game. It's in Buffalo. It's the first one for a long time. There's a lot of motion behind it.
Retiring Thurman Thomas's number at half.
Yeah, it's, and even though the Patriots, you can get into that mindset of, maybe this game is going to be a little bit easier than we expected, and you can fall into that trap, although they do a good job of that. And at the end of the day, they found a way to win. And the idea that Cordarrelle Patterson ran the ball just three times less than Saquon Barkley's average, to me, is
Coach can't get
mind boggling.
He's on a corner. It's don't budge him.
It's just one of those things where they needed to run the ball. They had to find a way to run the ball. I thought it was actually a great idea. I like the idea of him working some more in the backfield, a way to get an explosive player some touches. I thought that was a creative approach. They're not all going to be pretty. They're not all going to be easy. But it's another great example of they work James White. They find a role for Cordarrelle Patterson. Gronk didn't have a big day. But at the end of the day, they took what was there. They just kept
chipping away. They found a way to win. They found a way to win even if it was ugly. And the offense didn't score 38 points, or the team didn't score 38 points for the first time in this winning streak. You saw how much Sony Michel means to this team. That's the part that would concern me for the Pats. That we had to go to Cordarrelle Patterson to have some semblance of a rushing attack because our running back wasn't there. And it's not like we can say, but our running back, when he comes back, will be healthy the rest of the year. Not when he had knee issues in college. He had knee issues before the year started, and he's dealing with a knee issue now. That's the concerning part for me. But because they're the Patriots, the biggest moments of the game, it's 9-6. New England, Kyle Van Noy gets a strip sack. It's 12-6, New England. The Bills have a 3rd-and-3 at midfield, right at the start of the fourth quarter. Pats get off the field, and how do they respond to that? 10-play, 85-yard drive with a couple huge third-down conversions to really salt the game away. Because against this Buffalo offense, 2 scores is 10 scores. The game's over. That pick six was just bonus if you laid the 14 points. Like, the Patriots found a way to win, but if I'm a Pats fan, there were, some things that were concerning to me, most notably the lack of a rushing attack without Sony Michel that I think need to be addressed.
Yeah, the Sony Michel, you could tell they need more productivity from a running back. And that's how they changed this team this year. Because every year, Bill is trying to look at this team, how it's going to evolve. We know Edelman coming off the suspension, what he was going to provide. Gronk does not look like he's running the same way that he's run in years past. So they have Josh Gordon as a potential deep threat. We know what Hogan gives the offense, but from a running standpoint, Sony Michel was the only thing that's been really special. James White has not been a featured running back since 8th grade. I don't know if there's ever been a running back in the history of the NFL that hadn't been featured. We coached him in high school. He had Giovanni Bernard and other guys in the backfield with him. He went to Wisconsin. He was not featured there. And in New England, he is the perfect New England player. So when they move Cordarrelle to tailback, to me, I know there's a problem because it's not as if they have a surplus of wide receivers. So it's something I must watch. I believe his knee is going to be problematic as they go on. And Gronk's inability out last week because of a back. I don't see the burst in him. You don't see him running down the field. That's something I want to watch as New England goes into the month of November.
If we weren't talking about the Patriots, I'd actually be a little worried. I'd be like, oh, that sounds like they've got issues. And sounds like they've got some things they got to deal with. But
no, they have issues, but they have ability to be able to cover them up. I'm not going to look at this game and be like, man, there's some well-oiled machine. You could see where they're having problems. Tom, last night, as far as guys getting open, getting space, he had to get rid of the football a bunch of times against a Buffalo defense that has not had a consistent pass rush. So as we go throughout the season, he's missing his right tackle. Let's just watch. Let's just watch and see how they go about, because each week, they'll try to evolve into something. What we've seen the last 4 weeks, they were not last night against Buffalo, Coach.
But I love Cordarrelle Patterson in the backfield. I love this move because I think it's one of those things where it can evolve into a package. And that's usually what happens in New England is you try something as a solution to a problem. And then you say, okay, well, this actually has some merit as a package moving forward. How can we develop it? And that's a lot of times how ideas get off the ground, is it starts out of necessity. Something hits. So there's a few good things there. Now you bring him in as a wide receiver later on, and you can move him back into the backfield, maybe run some two-back type plays. I don't know where they're going with it, but I think you're going to see some more of it, and it gives them some interesting flexibility.
Tell me if I'm right here, though. You like it as an element, not if they were to have to rely on him as their main running back.
No, I think this week is one where they had to rely on him, or they felt like they could get some plays out of it. But there were enough good things that I could see this as being a package that they carry forward that teams have to prepare for, just like you have to prepare for James White in the backfield, different than Sony Michel, different from Cordarrelle Patterson.
Sure, like you can like what the Ravens are doing with Lamar Jackson in moments, but would feel very differently if Lamar right now had to be their quarterback. I know that's not exactly apples to apples, but it feels like that's what you're saying, which speaks to the point that we all agree that they need Sony Michel back. This team, what changed to me as far as their struggles early in the year and what they did over this five-game winning streak up until, really, Sony Michel got hurt, which is around the time the offense stopped clicking on all cylinders, was they had a consistent rushing attack between the tackles. There's a reason why they drafted him in the first round. I thought they drafted the second best Georgia running back in the first round. I thought Nick Chubb was better. Patriots, almost as always, know better than I do. They took a player that they could use. I do think they need him, even if Cordarrelle Patterson can be used in spot duty or in a specialty package.
Yeah, I kind of disagree with Coach here, because he had one run of 22 yards. All right, so after that, he had 9 runs for 16 yards. To me, the skill set, he is great in space, but the skill set from a wide receiver compared to the skill set of a tailback, I don't believe those running skills are transferable. So, yes, he did get a burst around the outside. They gave up the edge. He had 22 yards. But on the rest of them, he seemed to struggle. And most wide receivers that I know, they do not play tailback well. So I want to be able to see how that's going to evolve, because tailbacks, you can see the hole and the vision in front of you. Wide receivers, we're used to catching the football and the defense being back this way. So most of the time, the skill sets aren't transferable. Let's see what Bill Belichick, the greatest coach ever, let's see how he grows his role as a tailback.
Yeah, and I completely understand what you're saying. I just think that Cordarrelle hasn't really found a role there as a wide receiver, and he hasn't really found a role there in the league as a consistent wide receiver. To me, this is an attempt to see if they can get a few more plays out of him. I don't think it's going to be one of those things where he's going to be a great running back. It's more get him some reps, see what works, what doesn't work. How do we get this guy, who we know is talented,
yes,
just some touches?
Also, Cordarrelle, he was in Minnesota. They drafted him as a first-round pick. I know the wide receiver coaches. It's always been an issue with him as far as the information off the board into his brain and then what he's going to do on the field. So if Bill Belichick is able to get that out of him, that's going to be – the Vikings couldn't, the Raiders couldn't. Let's see if the Pats can get more out of him than they could.
It sounded familiar.
What?
Something taken from the ether and letting it seep in and making it work itself out.
Yeah, manifest stuff in your life as being real.
It was a joke. Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.